It's Christmas Eve of 1915. The 6th Battalion of the Northamptonshire Regiment are making their way up to the frontline trenches in an area of the Somme, or what was to become the Somme battlefield, called the D2 area, close to the German-held village of Fricourt. It's an area they know well, because you may remember from episode 3 of the story of the 6th North Ants that they'd encountered mine warfare and suffered numerous casualties here. But all is relatively quiet now. They relieved the 11th Battalion of the Royal Fusiliers in the trenches, but these trenches are in dreadful condition. There'd been heavy rain in a few weeks, and with the constant movement of men in and out the line, there was not just thick mud in the trenches, but a lot of water too, mixed in with that mud. Mixed in with the chalk that lies just below the surface in this part of France. It must have been fairly miserable for those lads from the county town of Northampton and the other villages and towns in that county as they settled down as best they could in those trenches and thought about their relatives at home. What would they be doing? Would they be gathered round the Christmas tree? Of course, they'd be thinking of their menfolk in the trenches, wondering how they were getting on. Maybe they were scribbling letters to each other. That was their only way of communication. After the terror of the mines that had gone off a few weeks before, things were fairly quiet. They're never quiet, are they, on the Western Front? Something was bound to happen to shatter the relative peace and to make their lives even more miserable. And something did happen. In the distance, they could hear the rumble of artillery fire. But those khaki-clad figures huddled in those cold trenches, suffering from the intense cold. Frostbite got evidence of that, and also lice. They knew that they were vastly outnumbered by the Germans opposite. They had scarcely enough ammunition to hold on if they were attacked. They still raised a smile at their comrades' jokes. Found humour, as soldiers always do, despite the fact that they were living in squalid misery. On that Christmas day, whilst they were thinking of their loved ones at home, never once for a moment did they forget the purpose for which they were there, or even consider the possibility of defeat. There was little enemy activity. Nevertheless, orders for the day came down. If the enemy shows any desire to fraternise, shoot! Says in capital letters. Boxing Day came and went, and the 27th arrived, and they're still in those trenches. The rain that had been falling, it continued. And then in the afternoon, the artillery used up a fortnight's supply of ammunition by firing some 800 shells into the German trenches in and around Fricourt. And 2 days later, on the 29th, yes, they're still in the trenches, they haven't been relieved. The Germans retaliated with 2,000 shells between 3:30 and 5:30 p.m. And mixed up in those shells was some gas. But what was to happen next would leave a stain on the reputation of the battalion and would be remembered by the men that were involved in this incident for decades to come. But what happened is covered very, very briefly in the official records. This was a German trench raid. It turns out that their normal commanding officers were not there that night. The battalion was being commanded by NCOs, sergeants and corporals. Because of the cold, most of them were sheltering in dugouts, trying to avoid the ferocious German artillery onslaught. But little did they know that creeping across no man's land were German soldiers. They were taking part in a much feared trench raid. So this is the fourth episode of a series of podcasts following the 6th Battalion of the Northamptonshire Regiment on the Western Front in the First World War. And we're going to talk about what happened in this trench raid tonight. But first of all, let's look at exactly what a trench raid was, what it was designed for, what was the purpose of it. Now, by this time, the trench system had evolved and stretched 450 miles from the English Channel down to the Swiss border. And the fighting was evolving all the time. The area between the enemy trenches was known as no man's land, and it was a key ground, especially at night. The area between the opposing trench lines, as we know, was known as no man's land, and this was a very dangerous place to be at night. And there was often fierce combat there between opposing troops, as patrols were sent out to gather information about each other's defensive positions. The idea of a trench raid was adopted by both sides, and it wasn't supposed to be a major attack, although there could be hundreds of soldiers involved at times with heavy artillery, but it was aimed at forcing a temporary entry into the enemy's frontline trenches in order to kill defenders, destroy fortifications, especially machine gun positions and weapons, gain intelligence by capturing maps and documents, and usually return with at least one prisoner that could be interrogated. And the attackers would carry specialised weapons, knives, knuckle dusters, and these dreadful improvised clubs, often with spikes sticking out of them. And these were useful, of course, in close-up trench fighting. Apart from that, trench raids were viewed by the British military authorities as a means of enforcing the offensive spirit of frontline troops. It meant that they couldn't get too comfortable and the enemy couldn't get too comfortable. But the ordinary soldier, most of them hated these raids, as well as the dangers of taking part in them. There was a risk of almost certain enemy retaliation afterwards. There was a soldier called Sidney Amatt of the London Regiment, and he described, in his own words, how raids were organised in his part of the line during 1916. This is what he said.
They never used to ask for volunteers. They used to say, you, and you were in the party. And they usually went over in silence at night, and you didn't carry any equipment. You know, all you carried was a rifle and bayonet. That's a few detail for that. The parties were arranged like this. Number one was the rifleman. He carried a rifle and bayonet and 50 rounds of ammunition and nothing else. The next man was a bomb thrower, a grenade thrower. He only carried a haversack, which was full of bilges and grenades. And the next man, he also was a bomb thrower, and he helped the first man replace his stock when he exhausted. And the last man was a rifle and bayonet man, and all he carried was a rifle and 50 rounds of ammunition and a bandolier slung over his shoulder, nothing else. The idea was to crawl through the German wire, try and get underneath, and jump into their front line trench, dispose of whoever was holding it by bayonet, if possible, without making any noise, or clubbing over the head with the butt. Then you drop into the trench once you establish yourself and wend your way round each bay. First of all, a rifleman would go leading, and then he'd stop at the next bay, which was normally a part which was unoccupied, and the bomb thrower would then throw a grenade towards the next bay of their line, or where he thought it would be, judging from the distance of the other one. Just after it exploded, the man who was leading, the rifleman, he'd dash round into the trench where their bomb they had just gone off and dispose of any occupants that were left behind. And so he'd go on until we cleared the whole trench.
I don't know about you, but as I listen to that, in some ways, it's more scary than going on a full-scale attack. I can't imagine having to kill someone close up with a club, a hand grenade, knuckle duster, any of these other dreadful weapons they were using. But then again, they hadn't necessarily volunteered to do this. You do what you're told, don't you? And going back to these Northamptonshire lads, it's not them carrying out a trench raid tonight. They could be on the receiving end of one. I've got battalion diary in front of me. There's just a few lines about it. It says, towards the end of that artillery bombardment that we were talking about earlier, a party of the enemy entered our trenches west of the cemetery and surprised 20 of our men who'd taken cover in a dugout. These men were made prisoners and taken away to the German lines before the posts on their right and left became aware of this occurrence. So in this situation, they've used stealth. They've been very quiet. They've managed to bypass the men that are on lookout, gone into a dugout. And as they've gone into a dugout, the common practice was to throw a hand grenade down the steps before you go in. And those boys in the dugout would just hear this sound. They were probably asleep or relaxing or writing letters or maybe just chatting to each other. They'd have been startled when they looked up to see this party of enemy soldiers in front of them. And what happened next was that they simply surrendered. What choice did they have, those 20 lads? Back across no man's land they went into the German trenches. They must have been scared stiff. They didn't know what was happening to them. They didn't know what was to become of them. We know at least one of them was badly wounded. It wasn't until April of 1916, some 4 months later, that the people of Northampton were to discover that their boys had been taken prisoner and were still alive. Their photos were displayed in the Northampton Independent newspaper. And whilst the battalion diary didn't go into any detail about it, there is a little bit more detail in a newspaper report. It's a story of how those men came to be captured. Was written by an officer of the regiment as follows. The circumstances under which these men were captured were briefly these. At 4 p.m. on the evening of the 29th of December, the enemy subjected the sector of the trenches held by the regiment to a very heavy bombardment with high explosives and gas shells. This lasted for an hour and a half, the front of the platoon being totally destroyed. The platoon was in command of an inexperienced NCO who allowed his men to take cover in a dugout without taking proper precautions against surprise. The Germans, as bad luck would have it, selected this subsector for a bombing attack, and cleverly lifting their fire to the adjoining subsectors, surprised and captured the occupants of the dugout, with the exception of 4 men who escaped and brought the information to the troops in the adjoining portion of the trench. They promptly launched a counter-attack, which the Germans did not wait for, but escaped with the loss of 1 man killed. The incident, although unfortunate, is considered a very good object lesson to all new recruits, as in spite of all communications being cut by the bombardment, the counterattack was organised and launched with great promptitude. The casualties of that period in the trenches were only 21, in addition to those missing taken prisoners, which, considering that it computed that 4,000 shells were put into ours and the adjoining sectors in the course of 1.5 hours, may be considered very light. We've got a few words here that are spoken by a British private, a man called Walter Spencer, and he described the process of capturing an enemy prisoner.
Well, you try and get down to a part of the enemy trench where you thought it was least manned, you see, and you grab a prisoner if you could, and of course he'd give a gawk, and that's when the fun started, because directly he shouted that they'd manned the trench, you see, and anything that was moving they would put on. But invariably you could get a rope to come, directly you got him out of the trench, he'd come with you, all right, and he'd get him back to the line. But it was a very hazardous job. We lost a lot of men on patrols, of course.
Now, you remember those weapons that we were talking about that they used in this trench raid? Here, a British private called Basil Farrer, he gives us a good description of some of those weapons that they used.
Well, I do remember, too, seeing our bombers, and I'd never seen them. They were issued with, it's the first time I'd seen them, with knob carriers with nails in the end, studs. Never seen those before. Oh, and I remember very well one of them, you know, waving about. Fortunately, I had a tin hat on, because he hit me on the top of the head with it. And even then, I felt it, but the cart you were without the tin hat, but they were a nasty-looking thing. The idea was, you'd throw a bomb down the dugout. If there were any survivors that come as they came out, you'd wallop them with this club.
Now, one thing that I don't understand is really in these accounts the amount of artillery shells that were fired at the North Ants that night, how the casualties were so light. The Commonwealth War Graves Commission website shows us that there were just 3 men killed on the 29th of December, and 2 of those were in the artillery bombardment. George Gough was a sergeant. He was 26 years old and married to a lady called Ada, and they ran a pub in Melbourne Street in Northampton called the East End Tavern, one of those places that's no longer there, and he's buried in a nearby cemetery. Back home in Northampton, the newspaper says, a letter has been received from Colonel Ripley, states that he was killed instantaneously by shellfire. He had only got married to Ada just before leaving England in June of 1915 and had formerly worked at the Bective Shoe Factory in Kingsthorpe. His wife chose the words for his headstone. She says, duty nobly done from his sorrowing wife, Ada. Now, the only man that was captured that night who died was a man called Jesse Chamberlain, and he was buried in the AIF burial ground near Fleur, some miles back from where they'd been captured. And this tells us that he must have been taken back there, wounded, and perhaps treated at a German medical post before succumbing to his wounds. And his sister, she was called Ada, and she chose the words for his headstone, and there are quite a lot of them. It says, Jesse, who died as prisoner of war and was buried at the time at Fleur, but whose grave was destroyed in later battles, their glory shall not be blotted out. And he has a special memorial there rather than a known grave. I'm very grateful to a man called Jonathan Porter, who lives on the Somme and has written a couple of brilliant books about the Somme battlefield. And he gave me some information about those men that were captured. And I've been able to piece together who they were through the information that he's given to me and through looking in the archives and newspaper reports. And many of them, happily, did return to Northampton and went on to leave full and successful lives. It wasn't until April, I think I said earlier, that the Germans, via the Red Cross, gave the British authorities a full list of the men that they'd captured. And it told us where they were from, with the majority being from Northampton, one was from Kettering and one from Higham Ferrers. And some were from a bit further away, places like Rochdale, which is in Lancashire. One of those men was called Fred Trasler. Came back to Northampton in 1919. He got married in 1923 and lived in the St James's area of Northampton. And he lived until he was 88 when he died in 1984. Then there was William Truss. I've even got a photograph of him in old age. He lived until 1980. He'd got married to Violet in 1919. And when he died in 1980, he was 87 years old. In 1939, I found him on the register, living in Peterborough and working as a railway engine driver. Philip Innes, he was another one of those that was captured that night, and he was badly wounded. His service record shows that he'd suffered a gunshot wound to his left eye. Now, rather than being a gunshot wound, I would suspect that was a piece of the grenade that went into his eye when it was thrown into the dugout there. And in November of 1917, he was so badly wounded that the Germans exchanged him through the repatriation scheme via the Red Cross in Switzerland. He became a plumber before the end of the war. In July of 1918, he married Ethel, and they welcomed a daughter, Vera, into the family in 1919, and he lived until 1972, when he died at the age of 77. I think that's good news, isn't it, that despite what happened that night, the terror that they must have faced, they survived to tell the tale, and at least in two or three cases, they went on to have long lives. So back in the trenches on the Somme, life went on. The new year of 1916 opened quietly. And it was a year that the Northamptons were really to make their mark during the Battle of the Somme, which is yet to come. The first 3 months were spent in putting the sector in good order to hand over, because they were moving to a different sector. But whilst in the line, Colonel Ripley himself, the commanding officer, and his adjutant, Captain Beecham, they were wounded by a stray shell. But only relatively minor injuries occurred. And Colonel Ripley, he went home for 3 months, but he insisted on returning to take part in the training for that big push that was on the way. Snipers and more raids by day and night made this part of the Somme too lively to be anything but uncomfortable. And on one day there was a Captain Burrows, and he and two men were killed by a German sniper who'd crawled out into no man's land into a shell hole near their lines. That must have had a very demoralising effect on the battalion as well. And back home in Northampton, a William Nichols has returned home in February, lived in Paul Street, and he'd been wounded on February the 6th in the left arm and thigh, and his arm had to be amputated at the stationary hospital in Rouen. He was 23 years old and was another one of those men that had joined up at the start of the war. In the middle of March 1916, the battalion diary tells us that they went into a new sector of the frontline trenches, a section called A2, just north of Carnoy village, and they replaced the 7th Battalion at the Bedfordshires. And they were also, like previous trenches they'd occupied, in a very bad state of repair. And the first thing they encountered, like they'd done, a few miles away at Freecourt on the 13th, the enemy fired a mine beneath them. There were 6 casualties. And the battalion was to get to know this area of the battlefield very well, because it was from here that they would go over the top in the great push on the 1st of July that was still some 3-4 months away. But they were preparing whilst holding the line. Preparations were going on for this big push. Nobody knew when it was going to be, but they must have got an idea of where it was going to be. And as part of these preparations, there was a Lieutenant Aubrey Webster who'd been commissioned into the Northamptonshires, having joined up at the beginning of the war, and he was 27 years old. He'd been taken out of the line and he went to a bombing school, and he was training soldiers how to throw those Mills bombs that were going to be so important. Unfortunately, one of those hand grenades went off prematurely and he was killed. Aubrey was the son of the Reverend J. Webster from Ombersley Vicarage, which is in Worcestershire, and he's buried in the Bray Military Cemetery. When news reached his subordinates back in the trenches, they must have felt his loss just as much as any other soldier killed in action, this man killed by accident. Barely gets a mention in the battalion diary. Perhaps these things were more frequent than we realise. But just 12 days before that, having experienced the horror of that trench raid at Christmas, they were raided again in the early hours on the 13th of April by the Germans. The Germans preceded the raid with a terrific bombardment that flattens the Northamptonshire's trenches. They came over in a terrible rush. And that night, one of their commanding officers was there, a Colonel Podmore. He went on to command the 12th Battalion of the Middlesex, but was also killed in an accident on New Year's Eve of 1917. But this night he was described as a fine, fearless officer, beloved by all, and during this night raid he showed a brave example and he encouraged his men to cling heroically to their battered remnants of a trench, despite the fact that his company had been practically wiped out. There was 10 men killed, 34 wounded and 2 captured. And 6 of the men that were killed belonged to a special wiring party that had been chosen from volunteers to go out on dangerous work. They'd completed their task, they were trying to get back to their own trenches when they were mistaken for Germans. And guess what? They were killed by friendly fire, killed by their own side. The raid was repulsed, the Germans had suffered heavy casualties, and a few of them were taken prisoner by the British, by the North Ants on this occasion. What the battalion diary doesn't tell us, but an official report does, is that 2 more Northamptonshire men were wounded and carried off by the enemy. Captain Podmore himself, together with 4 NCOs, were recommended for decorations, and in fact Podmore was awarded the Distinguished Service Order. Got more information here about Podmore. It says that he was an assistant master at rugby school, well known in cricketing circles. He was an excellent fast bowler. The news was received from Lieutenant Colonel Windau, the commanding officer at that time of the 6th North Hampshire, if you remember, the regular commanding officer. Ripley was still back in England recuperating. And the notice said, "We've got news that Captain Podmore has got the DSO for gallantry and devotion to duty on the morning of the 13th of April, when his company, after enduring an intense bombardment, repulsed a raid that the enemy attempted on our front line. Though he only had one young officer doing duty with the company, they stuck to their parapets like heroes, inspired by the coolness and entire disregard of danger of their commander." Well, the official records there in the battalion diary says that they suffered 10 men killed that night, but on the Commonwealth War Graves Commission website, I found 14 of them that died that day. 13 of them are buried in adjacent graves in the Carnoy Military Cemetery, and one is missing and he's on the Teepval Memorial. And one of those men was Lance Corporal Arthur Walden. He came from Bridge Street in Northampton. And that same commanding officer, Windrow, he wrote a letter to his parents. He says, "During a very heavy bombardment of our lines, your gallant officer, whilst with others successfully defending our front trench, met his death by a shell." Tribute to Lance Corporal Walden's good comradeship was also paid in a letter from a fellow signaller. And before enlisting at the commencement of the war, Walden was employed at Messrs Phipps & Co. and he was nearly 23 years of age. Phipps & Co. was and still is a local brewery. There was great news for the battalion on the 24th of May, because George Ripley, their CO, returned from convalescing in England after recovering from his wound, and he took over command of the battalion again, and preparations were to continue for the great push. The following day, a draft of 38 NCOs joined the battalion, and on the 26th of May, they were strengthened by over 100 reinforcements arriving from base. Now we go into June. On the 1st of June, the battalion was mentioned in dispatches by Sir Douglas Haig, who said that they'd been involved in gallant service. On the 4th and 5th of June, they came out of the trenches and went back several miles. And throughout the rest of the month, battalion diary tells us that they trained in assault on trenches. They were practicing for this great push. And on the 21st of June, battalion diary says they performed a final assault practice over trenches that had been specially built to replicate the defensive positions that they were to attack at 0 hour. On the 24th of June at 2 a.m, the battalion diary tells us that that great artillery bombardment of enemy trenches commenced. And on the 28th, there was a recce of officers of the forming up trenches that they were to use at the beginning of the coming attack. They found that some of those trenches were not in great condition, so the following day they started to repair them. And on the 28th, with the attack due to start, it rained hard all day and the condition of the trenches became very bad. The forming up trenches were completed, wire on our line of advance was removed, and all preparations for the attack completed. It was thought that the attack would start tomorrow, but probably owing to the weather, instructions were received that 0 hour would be postponed for 48 hours. On the 29th, the weather cleared, the ground began to dry up. And then it was the 1st of July, that big push. Preparations were now complete. All that remained now were for the men to wait, their nerves strained to breaking point. They were tense, no doubt, with excitement. They didn't know what was ahead of them. It was an unknown tomorrow. There was a private, J. Swainland, and he says that one night in June 1916, I was in a party on night patrol in the vicinity of Carnoy when we came under heavy mortar fire and I fell severely wounded. When the rest of the party returned to our lines and found I was missing, three of them came back to find me lying on the German side of the wire with 28 wounds. Somehow they managed to get me through the wire and safely back to our lines. I owe my life to those three unknown comrades. I wonder who those unknown comrades were. whether they took part in that attack on the 1st of July. And that's going to be the fifth episode of this series of podcasts about the 6 North Ants. Perhaps the most famous day of all that we've talked about in several episodes of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, call Tales from the Battlefields. In a few weeks' time, we'll pick up their story again. But it's not a story of failure, it's a story of success in this part of the battlefield. And we'll find out what the contribution was from their men from my home county of Northamptonshire. But until then, once again, I'd like to say thank you for taking the time to tune in to the podcast. If you could, I'd be very grateful if you could leave a rating and a review on Spotify or Apple or wherever you get the podcast from. That really does help. And we've talked about a few of these men that died during the period that we've been discussing this week. Jesse Chamberlain, Aubrey Webster, to name but two. And Arthur Walden, who was killed in that raid in April. All of them died in defence of their country. And I know we quite often, usually, play The Last Post. But I don't know why, but this week I wanted to play something different. And there's a famous hymn that he sung at this time of year, I Vow to Thee, My Country. It was sung by a man called Ramin Karimloo at the Festival of Remembrance 5 years ago at the Royal Albert Hall in London. And I'd like to play that for you now to end this week's podcast.
Dearest and the